The United States is the world's oldest democracy. India, with nearly 1.3 billion people, is the world's most populous democracy. Besides sharing democratic governance, both countries also share a wariness of a rising China. This overlap in values and interests has sparked a lot of talk about deepening U.S.-Indian relations and possibly even creating a partnership. Donald Trump is certainly a big fan of India. He said shortly after taking the oath of office, quote, "By the way, India's doing great. Nobody talks about it. I have big jobs going up in India, but India is doing great," end quote. By all accounts, Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi feels positively toward Mr. Trump and the United States. Last year, the Prime Minister delivered an address to a joint session of Congress. In it, he highlighted the interests and values that the United States and India share.
Ties of commerce and investment are flourishing, as in trade, so in defense. Defense purchases have moved from almost zero to $10 billion in less than a decade. Connecting our two nations is also a unique and dynamic bridge of 3 million Indian Americans. They are your strength. They are also the pride of India. They symbolize the best of both our societies.
I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. You're listening to The President's Inbox, a CFR podcast that examines the foreign policy challenges facing President Donald Trump. We look at the issues topping his inbox and discuss what he has said he will do and what constraints he might face. This week, we're talking about U.S. relations with India. Joining us for that discussion is Alyssa Ayers. Alyssa is CFR's Senior Fellow for India, Pakistan, and South Asia. She is an expert on India's role in the world and on U.S. relations with South Asia more broadly. In fact, she's just back from a trip to India as part of working with a bipartisan congressional delegation that visited Delhi in Hyderabad. I should also note that Alyssa was a Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, what we call a DAS, at the State Department during the Obama administration. She blogs regularly for the CFR blog Asia Unbound. You can find it on CFR.org. And you should keep an eye out for her forthcoming book, Our Time Has Come, How India is Making Its Place in the World, which you can pre-order later this year. Alyssa, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just dive right in. And I want to begin with sort of situating the broad relationship between the United States and India. And I guess my first question would be, how did Indians react to the election of Donald Trump?
So unlike many countries around the world, which have been concerned about the Trump administration changing directions in U.S. foreign policy, India has been, you know, neither sort of celebratory nor concerned. You've seen the hope, I think, that the Trump administration will continue what's been a bipartisan pursuit of better ties with India. And you've also seen the Modi government reach out early. Prime Minister Modi was one of the first congratulatory calls to President Trump, President-elect Trump at the time, the day after the election. So November 9th, they spoke on the phone. It's been kind of interesting. Trump entered office very positively predisposed towards India. He, as you mentioned, has had his own business investments there. I was traveling in Pune in January and opened the magazine.
Okay, where's Pune for?
Pune is in western India, in the state of Maharashtra, and the Trumps have some properties going up there. I opened the magazine of the hotel I was staying in, and there was a two-page spread for Trump Towers, which I found kind of interesting. But, you know, we have never before had a presidential candidate who recorded a campaign ad in Hindi. Candidate Trump did that. It was really kind of a surprise. He
spoke to Indian American groups in the fall during the general election campaign.
He did, exactly. He spoke at a rally that was focused on raising funds to support victims of terrorism, and he went and you know, addressed this group at this big rally that took place in New Jersey. So that was a pretty interesting development. We haven't seen that level of engagement in a presidential candidate before.
So has anything happened in the 7+ weeks that Donald Trump has been president to change that rather warm view Indians have toward him and his administration?
So there have been two points of concern that have deepened in India in the last 7 weeks. The first of these has to do with safety and security of Indian Americans and Indian citizens who happen to be in the United States. There are a lot of people who are working in the United States who are Indian citizens. You might have read in the press about the murder of a Kansas City area engineer who was from Hyderabad, India. He and a colleague, both technology workers in the Kansas City general area, were shot at in a bar. They had gone to this bar just after work to, you know, relax and have a drink. Some man came in there and started asking where they were from and what kind of visa they were on, really sort of harassing them. That man was asked to leave the bar, and he came back with a gun, shot these two men from India, one whom died and the other who was wounded and in the hospital. So that captured a lot of attention in India and a great amount of concern. There have been some other cases, including a shooting of a Sikh American, an attempted burning of somebody's store because the perpetrator believed that the owner was quote-unquote Arab. It was an Indian-American owner of a store. And there was also a case of a person in Ohio who has been stalking people and posted a video online saying he wants people who are working here to leave the country. So there's been a lot of concern about
what kind of coverage. I mean, you were just in India. Yeah. What kind of coverage do these stories get in the Indian press?
A lot of coverage. People are very concerned about it. You know, the Indian American population, whether people who are, you know, U.S. citizens or people who are permanent residents or working in the U.S., this has been a great diaspora. It's been a diaspora that's become politically engaged and involved in the U.S., and it's been a real bridge between India and the United States, a productive bridge between both countries. So I think it's come as kind of a shock to see this kind of anti-foreigner, a level of violence picking up, and people are really concerned about that. Earlier today, India's Foreign Minister was asked in Parliament. She made some comments about the fact that India is, you know, watching this very carefully and has been in communication with the Trump administration about their concerns about the safety and security of their citizens abroad.
Are they worried that the Trump administration is not doing enough to criticize these kinds of attacks?
Since President Trump did speak about the Kansas City attack in his address to Congress, that concern, I believe, has been allayed. But he didn't mention the Kansas City attack for some time, and that did cause in India a sense of, well, why doesn't he mention this? You know, somebody was just shot, you know, on the basis of not being a U.S. citizen. What is going on in the United States? So I do think you see people really concerned about what seems to be happening with some of this kind of emerging, you know, violence directed against foreigners.
Well, let's look at the U.S.-India relation in historical context. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a lot of talk right now, as I mentioned at the opening, about the potential for deepening cooperation between India in the United States. But for many years, throughout much of the Cold War, even after the Cold War ended, there was a fair amount of hostility between Washington and New Delhi. Can you sort of help us understand how that came to be and how we moved away from those tensions?
Yeah, well, that's a very long story, so longer than our half hour
here.
So
give us a Cliff Notes version.
Just a Cliff Notes version. So, you know, the United States had championed the idea of India's freedom from colonial rule. FDR was a champion of Indian independence.
It was part of the British Empire.
Exactly, and achieved its independence in 1947. India, you know, furrows its own path when it comes to foreign policy. India has not wanted to be part of any alliance one way or another. So during the Cold War, I mean, you were either with us or you were with the Soviet Union. So India, through its leadership of the non-aligned movement and its belief—
That was Nehru, correct?
Yes, absolutely. And then carried forward by, of course, his daughter and then successive prime ministers after her.
His daughter being?
Indira Gandhi. That orientation towards policy independence and really, you know, having your own independent view in the world kept India and the United States on two different sides of the Cold War. This was exacerbated by the U.S. focus on non-proliferation issues. India tested nuclear devices in 1974, which came after the cutoff in the NPT to be accorded status as a nuclear weapon state.
It was on the outside looking in.
Totally on the outside looking in. And that has been kind of India's situation on a lot of these major institutions of global governance. I think you see a real push now in India to be more on the inside and carve space for itself within these larger institutions of global governance. But for a long time, we were on very different sides of some tough, contentious issues. President Clinton was the first U.S. president to really kind of break that narrative. He took a long trip to India in March 2000. It was the first visit by any U.S. president to India, I think, 22 years. His trip was 5 days long. I mean, he traveled all over. The visuals from that visit were incredible. I mean, President Clinton dancing with women in Rajasthan. You kind of can't forget that, this level of warmth and kind of openness. And that made a big difference, I think. Of course, President Bush came into office already declaring, I mean, you know, as a candidate, he'd said he wanted to have a much deeper relationship with India. He was amazed by the fact of India's enormous democracy and wanted to deepen ties. It was under President Bush that the U.S. and India put together the civil nuclear agreement that for the first time in really 30 years.
Why was that so significant?
Because this had been a, you know, what former U.S. ambassador to India, Frank Wisner, has called a cinder in the eye of the U.S.-India relationship. This, you know, our divide on nonproliferation was so significant that it was oftentimes very difficult to overcome that kind of huge elephant in the room and move together on any other kind of issues. By being able to work together and by finding a way to collaborate on the civil nuclear energy component of these issues while sidestepping question of India's strategic program, this kind of opened up whole new areas of defense and security cooperation, high technology cooperation, because India was under different sanctions, U.S. sanctions prohibiting export of dual-use technologies, these kinds of things that were linked to our non-proliferation rules. So overcoming that hurdle actually both symbolically allowed the two countries to kind of start off on a new path together, and it also, in very pragmatic terms, opened up this whole new area of defense and security cooperation, which has really blossomed
in the
last 8 years.
So it was in some sense a reset.
Absolutely.
That allowed the United States
yeah.
and India to develop cooperation in areas that they couldn't before,
right.
precisely because of our non-proliferation policy, the NPT, in rules Congress had passed, laws Congress had passed, requiring certain sanctions or denying certain benefits to countries that weren't in compliance with the NPT.
That's absolutely right. And that has now been overcome. India and the United States are doing a lot together on civil nuclear energy. India has just joined the Missile Technology Control Regime last June. It's a
big deal for India.
So
what is the Missile Control Technology Regime?
Well, there are four major regimes that govern the transfer of technology.
Regime, you mean these are like rules and institutions?
Elective groupings of countries that are active in this space. So, for example, the Nuclear Suppliers Group is the set of countries that are involved in using civil nuclear technology, and it governs how they can relate to each other. In order to pass the civil nuclear energy deal with India, for example, one piece of that was the United States working very hard within the NSG to get an exemption to allow NSG members to be able to trade with India on civil nuclear energy technology. India has applied for membership in the NSG now. At the last consideration of membership, which was last June at the plenary session that took place in Seoul, Korea, by all accounts, China, you know, this is a group that makes decisions by consensus. So if you have one holdout, nothing moves. China.
True of many international groupings and arrangements.
Yeah, absolutely. Think of the WTO. I mean, and India has been a tough partner in the WTO.
Well, we're going to get to that.
Yeah. But finding a path for India to become a member, to become inside the non-proliferation regimes when it had been outside for many years has been a big deal. It's meant that what India has done internally, it's changed its own domestic laws, has much more stringent export controls on this kind of material or dual-use materials. And so India has now really adopted all the same rules and restrictions for its own segment in this space. And it is now applied to become a member of all four of these. So it's a big deal.
Through several administrations, the United States has been working with its counterparts in India to reset the relationship, put it in a different direction. There's been a fair amount of progress on that. However, I don't think we should overstate how close the two capitals have become. They're not allies.
Right.
Not likely to become allies anytime soon, correct?
Right.
In any formal sense.
My view is that India is not interested in a formal alliance with any partner, but it is definitely not interested in being I think Indian leaders have long viewed alliance relationships as somehow causing a subordination of one country's, the country that is not as powerful, of one country's views and independence. And so you see this over and over again in a lot of Indian writing about its own independent foreign policy. They don't want to be seen as anybody's junior partner. So I don't think an alliance, a qua alliance, is on the cards.
And by that mean like formal treaty, we will sit down and sign a document.
Right.
That sort of thing.
Right. India definitely wants to protect its ability to take its own decisions at every step of the way. It doesn't want to have a specific set of decisions pre-decided for it on the basis of an alliance requirement. But you do see a strong interest in having a close strategic relationship with the United States. And so that has really been a big shift over the course of the last 10, 15 years.
Do we have any sense, Alyssa, as to how the Trump administration is going to approach that opportunity? Maybe it's just a preliminary question. Does the Trump administration, to the best of your knowledge, see it as an opportunity that it wants to pursue?
From whatever we've seen, nobody has made any speeches about U.S.-India ties in the Trump administration yet. What we have seen from the president on the campaign trail, and you mentioned his comment, after inauguration, India is doing great, nobody's talking about it. I think the administration does view India very favorably, wants to continue expanding ties with India. I think it views India as a big economic opportunity. The president, of course, has experienced India as an economic opportunity that's likely to continue going forward. It's also a big strategic opportunity. Some of the first phone calls that have taken place in the administration, of course, Secretary Tillerson spoke with his counterpart, Minister Swaraj, in mid-February. Secretary Mattis spoke with his then counterpart, India's former defense minister, Parikar, who has now just moved to become the chief minister of the state of Goa. That just happened as a result of these state-level elections. So there will be a new defense minister shortly. Right now, the finance minister has assumed additional charge. But you've seen those kinds of early stage setting conversations between counterparts, hopefully to get the relationship off on a good footing. India's foreign secretary was just here at the end of February and first part of March. He met with Secretary Tillerson, Secretary Ross at Commerce, Homeland Secretary Kelly, National Security Advisor McMaster, and Deputy National Security Advisor Ken Juster. So, and also he met with a lot of members of Congress. So you do see the Indian government trying to focus on getting India on the agenda early and establishing good ties.
Should we make anything of the fact, or maybe a better way to put it is, are Indians making anything of the fact that U.S. officials have been going abroad, but they haven't been stopping in India? I will note that you mentioned Secretary Mattis, the defense secretary. First trip, he went to Asia, but he went to Northeast Asia, Seoul in Tokyo. Then he went to Europe. Secretary Tillerson has been to Germany to talk to NATO members. And he is now on a trip. I believe he's in Tokyo today. Right. He'll be in Seoul and then Beijing. No one's made a stop in Delhi.
Right.
Are people in India noticing that?
Not yet. The latest that I have seen is that shortly, I think the president spoke with India's prime minister 2 or 3 days after his inauguration and invited him to visit. Now, I have not heard of any official dates being set for that. There's been some speculation in the Indian press that Modi could visit the United States as early as May. If his U.S. visit does happen soon, then I think people in India will feel reassured that this is a relationship that the Trump administration does want to take forward. Now, if that visit—
Would that be an official state visit?
I don't believe it would be a state visit. I mean, the president seems to have been having a lot of different visits with world leaders that are not yet state visits.
Can you help us understand, because you were in the State Department, what's the difference between an official state visit and a visit? I mean, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was in Washington. He went down to Florida, to Mar-a-Lago, to play golf with the president and conduct business. That wasn't a state visit.
Right. It's the level of formality and the level of activities undertaken that involve more outsiders. When you have a state visit, there's a full program, a big ceremonial welcome, certainly some kind of ceremonial dinner, a very large ceremonial dinner usually in the White House lawn. The working visits are going to involve a smaller number of people, typically not a lot of activities that involve outsiders, perhaps meetings that are very specifically focused on either setting a blueprint for what the upcoming agenda will be, or trying to hash through if they're working together on some important agreement that needs to be finalized.
So as conversations between Washington and New Delhi continue, in your view, where are the opportunities for the Trump administration? If you are giving them advice, recommendations, because you've worked this issue for a long time. And as I mentioned, you were a deputy assistant secretary of state at DAS in the parlance of Washington. Where should the administration be looking to make progress with India?
So first, I'd say defense. Defense ties have really blossomed in the last 8 years, and there is an incredible trajectory to do more together. India's priorities are to continue this intensive military modernization that it's on. India is very focused on becoming the preeminent power in the Indian Ocean. The United States is now doubling down on its own navy and its own maritime power. So there's a lot of convergence there, and a lot of interest in continuing what has become a quite strong relationship. India now, this is the oft-cited statistic, India exercises more with the United States now than with any other power.
These are military exercises.
Military exercises. And the U.S. exercises more with India than with any other non-NATO ally. So, our NATO allies, obviously, we're doing a lot with all the time. But as a non-NATO partner, India is the top of that list. So that's a big change from where things were 15 years ago. So I think that's going to be a continued area of opportunity. There is something called the Defense Trade and Technology Initiative that's focused on developing co-production and co-development opportunities in defense technology. A lot of enthusiasm on both sides, and I would imagine that continues. I think there's huge opportunity to do more on counterterrorism and homeland security, just as a kind of related but sort of administratively, bureaucratically separate space. Both India and the United States care a lot about fighting terror, and you see that this has become a much higher policy priority. I mean, this was, of course, a priority for all U.S. governments.
And it's important to point out to people that India has suffered some horrific terrorist attacks. Perhaps the most famous one here in the West was the attack in Mumbai at the Taj. But, this has been a persistent problem for India as well.
It's been a persistent problem for India, and it's been a space where India would like to see the United States help it more, not only on capacity building, but also on the challenge of trying to tackle the problem of terrorism that exists in Pakistan. So Pakistan is India's most difficult relationship. It's next door. It's a country that has terrorist groups that it doesn't fully shut down. The terrorist groups that are the group that was responsible for the Mumbai attack is something called the Lashkar-e-Taiba, which was nominally banned. It's not supposed to be operating in Pakistan, but there they are. They just launched a recruiting magazine earlier this week. I mean, this is supposed to be a banned group. Why are they launching a recruiting magazine?
Well, and it's a particular irritant in U.S.-Indian relations because India has for a long time argued that the United States has not been doing enough vis-a-vis Pakistan. And there's a long history of the United States being, I'm not sure if you would call it friend or partner, but certainly a supporter of various Pakistani governments.
It's an ally. It's a formal ally. Pakistan is a major non-NATO ally. It has that status in our system. And Pakistan.
But it's not an ally in the sense that we have a formal treaty of mutual defense with Pakistan.
Pakistan had been part of the CETO and the CENTO alliances, and it has been.
Those are acronyms I haven't heard in decades.
Well, that was, part of the problem of the Cold War is that during the Cold War, Pakistan was ready to throw their lot in with us.
Yep.
And India said, hey, we're independent. We're not going to tie up with anybody, even though they had this very close relationship with the Soviet Union. So in many ways, we not only were we on separate sides of these alliance relationships in the Cold War, but we had these alliances with the country that India saw as, one that was constantly trying to attack it. So that's been a challenge.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about potential frictions going forward. Obviously, Pakistan is potentially one, not necessarily. But what are the other kinds of potential frictions in U.S.-Indian relations, things that all of a sudden the Trump administration can find itself, despite wanting to have a friendship with India, on opposite sides of important issues?
Yeah. On the economic side, there's been an issue that I think will continue to be a challenge and how to figure out a way forward. India has emerged as the world's most progressive country, I should say most forward-leaning country, on the issue of movement of persons to provide services around the world. And there's been a lot of attention to this issue in the United States on the question of reforming the H-1B program. That's the category of visa for high-skilled technology workers. But India, you know, Prime Minister Modi is interested in building out India as what he's called the workforce of the world. So going beyond just the technology sector, but finding ways for the Indian skilled workers in all kinds of fields, whether it's being a chef or a carpenter or a yoga instructor, or I mean, there's a whole, you can imagine a whole list of different kinds of occupations. Prime Minister Modi sees this as one way of also finding gainful employment to meet what people in India refer to as this demographic dividend, needing to find employment for about 10 to 12 million people entering the workforce each year. So
10 to 12 million people entering the workforce each year.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of people. And, you know, what you see happening now, India has recently suggested within the context of the World Trade Organization that we should have some kind of agreement on global services. Now, the U.S. has gotten rid of the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was painstakingly negotiated over years by the Obama administration. The remaining countries that had negotiated the TPP are still going to try to take it forward, perhaps without us. But there is a parallel negotiation going on in Asia without the U.S. called the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership.
RCEP in parlance.
RCEP, exactly. And India has apparently, within the RCEP negotiation, put forward a proposal which India describes as a very ambitious proposal for more movement of, you know, labor mobility, movement of services professionals.
Well, RCEP is the Chinese brainchild.
Right.
Yeah, but it's not as extensive or intrusive or as in-depth as TTIP would be.
Right.
Would have been.
Right.
Not TTIP. TPP.
TPP. Right.
Well, either. Getting my acronyms mixed up.
Either, actually. Right. Yeah. Either one. That's exactly right. But so what you see happening is in the trade space, Indian trade negotiators are very focused on trying to find a more favorable set of rules for their own workers to perform services abroad. And this is challenging because it, you know, butts up against countries' own sovereign immigration policies. And so I think this is going to continue to be an issue, not only for India with the U.S., but with a lot of other countries, as you see concerns about immigration and labor markets all around the world.
Any other trade issues likely to be a problem in the relations?
I would anticipate that there will continue to be some concerns on the U.S. side with India's intellectual property rights rules. That's been an ongoing challenge for a long time.
There's several issues like
pharmaceuticals
and like
right.
in terms of whether money has to be paid the companies for their designs.
Right, exactly. Or what counts as an invention. Yeah,
right.
What can be patented, what counts as an invention. There used to be a lot of concerns on the U.S. side on the IPR world, specifically on copyright.
Yep.
And that's become a lot less of a concern because within India, content producers in the entertainment industry have become very, very active and India has strengthened its copyright laws.
Well, Bollywood is the world's biggest film industry.
Exactly. So Bollywood, exactly.
All of a sudden they discovered they have an interest in protecting copyright.
That's exactly what happens. I mean, so people who are, you know, the screenwriters and the directors and the songwriters all said, wait a minute, we need to be able to protect our own intellectual property here,
yeah, maybe,
too.
Maybe those American suggestions weren't bad ideas after all.
Yeah, that's actually been a really interesting transformation to watch. So that definitely has changed in the last 10 years.
Have we seen similar changes in areas like pharmaceuticals? Because for a number of years, India argued that it could go ahead and make drugs that under American rules, they couldn't without paying royalties or license fees.
Right. India changed its rules on this and began to recognize product patents. But IPR has been something of a focus for this Indian government, for the Modi government, and the Modi government has put together a kind of IPR task force. They're focused on trying to build up India as an innovation power. And so having a strong IPR regime to protect innovation and provide fruits to those who innovate is obviously important in that context. So some of the issues have been ironed out. It's my understanding that there's been a lot more communication on where there have been challenges. But there still are, you know, in these trade relationships, there's still going to be challenges. So I anticipate that there's going to be some continued complaints and concerns on the U.S. side.
So if we were to sit down a year from now, what is your sort of expectation of what realistically will have transpired in the U.S.-India relationship. How far can we get? How fast?
Can I add one other thing to answer that?
By all means.
Okay. You know, India has been concerned that the United States pays what people see as lip service to this idea that India should have a permanent seat in a reformed and expanded UN Security Council. And that is a precise phrase. I've said that phrase so many times, I know it by heart. I think there's really a sense in India that what should go along with its rise on the world stage and its support from strategic partners like the United States is greater support in the negotiating room to help carve that space for it in institutions where it doesn't yet have a formal position. So I would guess that in the next year, the UN Security Council is not going to be reformed because that takes forever. And that will be something that Indian leaders will still say, we need your help on this. Please do more to help us get
but
that seat.
Realistically, what is it that Washington could do on that front? Because it's a veto-wielding member of the UN Security Council, but it's not the only one.
That's right.
There are four others. One of which is China.
That's right.
Which, as best I can tell, has shown very little interest in granting India or pretty much any other country the singular rights that it has as one of the five permanent members.
That's right. Well, that's exactly right. And I think that's the real challenge to any kind of Security Council reform is that the powers that are on the Security Council with veto powers, you know, what's in it for any of them to work towards this expansion? I mean, for some countries, in fact, this is, you know, nothing in it for them. I mean, what's going to happen?
Yeah, well, but I mean, the Japanese think they should have a
right
a
and Brazil,
seat. Brazil,
Germany. I mean, you know, you look
Italy.
At look at what's happening with Brexit. I mean, yep. Are you going to see a kind of rump UK that still continues to have a seat? I mean, they're not going to want to give up a seat on the Security Council, even if the size of the country changes quite dramatically. So, I mean, there are real issues there, and I think those kind of procedural issues have stymied any progress on this. But I raise that because that's really the type of question that I think Indian leaders are looking to the U.S. to help support some sort of forward motion.
That may be something we describe as being of symbolic importance, but I think it's more than symbolic, quite heartfelt.
Yeah,
it's a recognition of status.
It's a recognition of status. It's quite heartfelt, and I think that you know, Indian leaders that goes beyond leaders. I mean, people generally who pay attention to global affairs. If you were to ask people in India, they say, you know, why don't we have a seat on the Security Council? This isn't fair. It's not fair to us. We're the world's largest democracy. Look what we've accomplished maintaining this democracy against the odds in many ways. So, you know, why aren't we accorded this too? So I do think people will increasingly look to the United States to deliver on that commitment of supporting Indian membership in the Security Council.
It seems to me pretty easy for the Trump administration or any American administration to commit to that. It's hard to deliver. One final question takes us back to the issue of Pakistan. There have been exchanges in recent months over the so-called line of control in Kashmir. We've mentioned that many Indians are unhappy historically with the United States for, in their view, being too close to a country that threatens them.
Yeah.
Since you also know quite a lot about Pakistan, what is your sense of the probability, likelihood of an escalation of violence there and the sense of what it is that New Delhi would expect from Washington should things escalate?
So things escalated last fall. There's been a series of attacks across the line of control, as you mentioned. I think what was most galling for people in India was that right after Prime Minister Modi made this goodwill stop in Lahore in Pakistan to, you know, help Nawaz Sharif celebrate on his birthday, December.
That's the Prime Minister.
Prime Minister of Pakistan. Help him celebrate on his birthday in 2015, December. Shortly after that goodwill peace gesture, there was an attack on an Indian army base across the line of control in Kashmir. Now, you saw another attack that took place in September. And what the Indian government had not done after these attacks was launch any kind of counterattack. This past fall, in September, they did, and they became very public about it. They said, we have launched what we called surgical strikes. We had intelligence information that there were terrorists assembling on what they called launching pads, ready to strike across India. And they said, we have carried out operations to neutralize this threat. The U.S. There was a phone call between India's National Security Advisor and the U.S. then National Security Advisor, Susan Rice, and the call readout that was released after that said very specifically, Pakistan has got to do something about these terrorist groups. So I think what you have now seen happening is a real clear statement of support from the United States for exactly the kind of messaging India would like to see happen. Pakistan has got to deal with this problem. They cannot expect the United States to constantly say, India, stand down if you've got terrorist groups attacking either military bases or civilian infrastructure. Pakistan cannot expect that the United States is not going to at some point say, you've got to cut this out. This is very, very serious.
No, so that's a big challenge for the Trump administration.
It's a huge challenge. Yeah. I don't anticipate that the Trump administration will have any patience at all with these issues. I mean, the Trump administration has been very clear all throughout the campaign that fighting terrorism, fighting ISIS is their very top priority. Pakistan has been harboring terrorist groups, including the Haqqani Network, which has caused problems for the United States in Afghanistan. This is a real issue. So,
It's a complex and thorny one. I mean, it's one thing to warn countries not to do certain things. There's always a challenge of what do you do if they don't listen to you? And it's made all the more complicated in this case because Pakistan is a nuclear power.
It's a nuclear power. It is a partner in support of the U.S. and NATO presence in Afghanistan. The ground lines of communication have gone through Pakistan. So this is, I think, the challenge for any policymaker is, you know, how far can you take your punitive measures when you need to have some sort of incentives to keep the cooperation going? And I think there's definitely, after 16 years in Afghanistan, there's now a sense, certainly among members of Congress, who, as far as I can tell, are really quite frustrated with what they see as Pakistan's lack of appropriate cooperation. But I think many people in the United States executive branch, and I think you're going to see that from the Trump administration, feel like, now, come on, you know, you can't continue to allow these groups either abetting actively some of these terrorist groups or just turning a blind eye and allowing them to, you know, plot their own actions from Pakistani soil and not expect that this is going to have repercussions for U.S.-Pakistan ties.
On that sobering note, we'll close up the President's Inbox for this week. Alyssa, thanks for joining us.
Happy to join. Thanks for having me.
Please subscribe to the President's Inbox on iTunes and leave us a review. It really helps. Opinions expressed in the President's Inbox are solely those of the hosts or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions. Today's episode was produced by Kevin Lizarazo, with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock, recording engineer Dan Mudd, and with special thanks to Audrey Bowler. This is Jim Lindsay. Thanks for listening. We'll see you soon on the President's Inbox.